Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Today, Governor Newsom's messaging on coronavirus was on mental health. We'll ask him why he focused on Californians coping with cabin fever. Plus, comedian Nikki Glaser talks a lot about being single, but now her stand-up will change to reflect the times.
Art is going to be impacted so much by this, and we don't even know in what way, but my next special is going to be a lot about this time.
It's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, we'll hear about the history of the USNS Mercy Hospital ship, currently docked in Los Angeles to help relieve area hospitals dealing with cases of COVID-19. It's actually the third Mercy to serve the nation.
The second pair, Mercy and Comfort, were built during World War II. Matter of fact, the second Mercy was built about a mile and a half north of where Mercy is docked right now, right there in Los Angeles.
Plus, since Take Two always aims to make you smile, comedian Nikki Glaser joins us to talk about dating under quarantine and a bunch of other really funny things, so stay tuned for that. First, though, Governor Gavin Newsom. During his daily press conference earlier this afternoon, he announced that he has tapped California Surgeon General Nadine Burke-Harris, who is a pediatrician well-known for work with trauma in kids, to put together a strategy for helping Californians deal with the psychological aspects of staying at home. And he made some time today to talk with us about this and other issues related to the COVID-19 outbreak. Governor Gavin Newsom, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, about the work that the Surgeon General is doing, why is it important to address people's mental health needs now?
The stay-at-home order is tough. It's tough on everybody, particularly families, particularly those that are elderly that already are struggling with social isolation, a lack of connection. And so I want folks to know this. Stay at home, but you're not alone. That we have resources, we have the capacity to meet your needs, not only those that feel the need to connect, but those that are in desperate need to connect, that are struggling with depression, deep anxiety, and that are seeing manifest in that anxiety and depression secondary health impacts where their diabetes is flaring or their asthma is flaring or their high blood pressure is becoming a potential risk factor. And we want them to know that on this COVID-19.ca.gov website, COVID-19.ca.gov website, we have resources and 16 hotlines to meet your needs.
Was there any particular reason for the timing of this? We're in our third week since you issued a statewide shelter in place. Have you been hearing that this is needed right now?
Yeah, I'm deeply concerned about children, those that may be being abused and we don't know about it, where you had the ultimate enforcement, and that was the recognition of our teachers that can sense when something's wrong with a kid and a family that were reporting those concerns. Now, because those kids aren't in school, we don't have those points of contact. And so that's raised concerns. I'm worried about domestic violence. I'm worried about people that have lost their jobs, that feel hopeless, that have lost their assets, that just don't know that this is ever going to end. Acting out inappropriately and hurting a loved one, and that loved one not being able to escape and not being able to communicate to law enforcement that abuse. I had two recent suicides just up here in Sacramento County. Mm. Teens in crisis that don't know how to cope with youth, let alone cope with this virus. And so we want to make all of these resources available as quickly as possible.
We're talking to California Governor Gavin Newsom. All right, let's talk about bed capacity. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, the forecasting model used by the White House, just yesterday predicted the United States overall may need fewer beds than what states are saying. And there are other models suggesting the peak in California may not be as bad as New York's. Can you tell us a little bit more about the seeming discrepancy between what California is saying and doing and some of these more optimistic outlooks are saying?
Yeah, I mean, the world is bottom up, not top down. Those are numbers in the aggregate. We don't live in the aggregate. Conditions exist and persist that are completely different in different parts, not only of our state, but substantively across the country. We are not New York because of the work that 40 million Californians have done to physically distance, to shelter in place, and to maintain their status of meeting this moment through appropriate hygiene and making sure that we're not spreading this virus. If we can continue to do that, it's absolutely true that we'll have bent that curve. We won't experience the kind of peak that other parts of the country are experiencing, not just New York, but New Jersey, Louisiana, Chicago, and other parts of the country. So we have to be vigilant. And ultimately, I hope all of our models are wrong. And if they're wrong, it's because we did the right thing and we didn't just assume that we are victims of fate. It was decisions, better decisions, that ultimately can bend that curve and ultimately improve our fate.
But when it comes to bending it, is that one of the reasons why you feel confident in lending out ventilators to the national stockpile to go to other states? Because you feel that maybe California is bending that curve enough where these things can leave the state?
Correct. Absolutely right. I mean, I was very proud. They'll arrive tonight, 100 in New Jersey, 100 in Illinois, 100 in New York. Ventilators arrive tonight. We're going to send them to Maryland and Delaware and D.C. and Nevada. And I'm proud that California is in that position. I'm proud that we'll have some announcements later this week on finding new supply chains for N95 masks that allow us not only to meet the needs of our frontline employees and first responders in the healthcare delivery system, but maybe beyond that and even help support some other states. That's the spirit of California. But again, if we let up, if we make the mistake, frankly, that's being made around the world, and that is people assuming they're out of this. You've seen this in Asia now, where they bent the curve, they met the moment through dramatic effect. Only the open restaurants and movie theaters.
And second wave, we're hearing about that, yeah.
You got it. Yeah. So we cannot allow that to happen in California.
Now, to the economy, there have been about 1.9 million insurance claims in the state, many so-called gig workers. A new federal law provides unemployment insurance to freelancers, but our understanding is California is waiting for federal guidance to implement that here. What's going on with this, and when will we see this happen?
No, well, we should see that take shape. And there's now, sadly, 2.3 million as of this morning that have filed since March 12th for unemployment insurance. And so we want to take care of those self-employed, not just those that are traditionally lose their jobs through larger employers. And we're going to make sure that those guidelines are clarified. We're dealing with an unprecedented number of inquiries into the system. We've reprioritized 800 additional staff just to deal with the call volume. The federal government's dealing with this themselves, and obviously local jurisdictions, counties.
But is there a firm timeline on this, Governor? Is there a timeline on this?
We should have clarity. There should be clarity. As far as I'm concerned, they're absolutely eligible, and we've been clear in terms of our guidelines. Anything that's being held up at the federal government, I can't speak to.
Now, but what about when it comes to the state, though? What else is being done by the state to help get the unemployment benefits out to the people?
We're doing it within the existing 800 people that I've redeployed specifically to deal with the call volume, to deal with the level of paperwork that is needed. And we are still within the traditional, back when we had 2,500 claims a day versus over 100,000 claims a day, still believe we can turn these checks around within the three-week, 21-day period that we had traditionally done even before we had this pandemic.
One more thing, Governor, last thing. Heading into this pandemic, California had a big reserve, a rainy day fund. Do you anticipate that being depleted as the state spends to help people recover, both physically and financially from this? Can anything be done to preserve some of it?
No. Period. No, that won't happen. 2.3 million people unemployed, unemployment rate that will get up to a number we've never seen in our lifetime. So the answer is no. And that's an honest answer. Forgive me. And I don't mean to be flippant in the response. I'm dealing with cold, hard reality facts. I'm working to completely repurpose my January budget in what we call the May revise. You'll see that reflected in what we'll pull back. But I'm looking at this, as I always do, from a budgetary lens of 3 years. And you look over 3 years, that reserve will not exist after the end of 3 years without significant economic stimulus and or support from the federal government.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom. Governor, thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. AMC theaters across the country closed last month because of the pandemic. Now they may never reopen. That's because last week, the financial agency S&P Global downgraded the company's credit rating to a level that puts AMC dangerously close to default imminent. To find out what this means, not just for the theater chain, but for a Hollywood that relies on movie theaters to show its films, we have the host of KPCC's The Frame, John Horn. John, welcome.
Hey, Abe.
All right. Now, AMC is the nation's largest theater chain, but what was the company's financial health before this crisis forced it to close its theater doors?
Well, imagine you're about to run a marathon and you've got shin splints and bad knees, and then you got to go run 26 miles. It wasn't in good health. It has a lot of debt, about $2 billion in current liabilities and almost $5 billion in debt. It has very little cash on hand. And even before the coronavirus hit, admissions in North America were flat to declining. So not a lot of people were going to theaters. AMC, like a lot of other chains, had spent a lot on upgrades. So even before all of this started, I would say AMC was not in the greatest of health.
Now, the health crisis forced Hollywood to shuffle or postpone new releases as well. How much did that uncertainty about when and what films theaters could play factor into these financial troubles for AMC?
I think it really just compounds the problem. I mean, obviously, they can't be open because they're not allowed to be open. But when you start thinking about when they might be open, is it June, July, August? What's going to be the situation then? I mean, a lot of the studios have taken some of their biggest movies out of the spring. They've pushed them into the summer. They've taken some of their bigger summer movies and pushed them in the fall or later. So if you're an exhibitor and you're looking at what you're going to play, you don't really know. Are you going to have Black Widow? Are you going to have Wonder Woman 1984? Mulan might come out in July, might not. The next Fast and the Furious movie, A Quiet Place Part 2, the James Bond sequel. If you're counting on those movies at a certain point in your schedule, they're not going to be there because the studios don't want to spend all the money marketing those films, not knowing when they're going to come out. So even when AMC and a lot of other theater chains open their doors, they don't really know what they're going to have to show.
John, how much does Hollywood depend on theater chains such as AMC to survive?
Well, I think that's going to be an interesting question. I mean, right now, they rely on them a lot, but the economics of exhibition have never been that great for movie studios. So if you have a movie that does maybe $100 million at the box office, the theater's going to keep maybe 50 of that, and the distributor is going to get maybe 50 of that. So basically, you're getting 50 cents on every dollar. Now, those are big dollars, and the U.S. and international global box office is billions of dollars. But if that goes away and you're releasing your movies on video on demand or on streaming where you keep almost 100% of the money, I don't know. I mean, it's a really interesting question. What movies will be like if they're not playing in theaters first? Will people know they exist? How much of a theatrical release is important to a movie, especially a big blockbuster like a Marvel film? We're entering uncharted territory here, and I think the question is the studios don't really know, but they're certainly starting to think about it.
What about other major theater chains out there? How many are in AMC's position as well? Or perhaps are there some that are just weathering this better than others?
Everybody is in trouble. I mean, up until a week or so ago, there were some drive-in theaters, some independent drive-ins that were still open, and most all of those have been closed too. And this is a global phenomenon. I mean, movie theaters around the globe are closed. And it's not just AMC, it's big chains like Cineworld, which owns Regal, Cinemark, another domestic chain, IMAX. You know, they're not only in some big malls, they're also in some museums that are closed. It is everybody who is in the exhibition business and, you know, everybody who works in those companies, people who are selling popcorn, people who are running projectors. I mean, the fallout from the close of exhibition has been massive. And it's not just, you know, these big companies that are really in trouble. It's everybody who works for them as well.
Then what does the movie business look like up and down the chain? If it's just, say, one company like AMC closes completely, shutters completely.
Well, I mean, it'll be a huge loss if there is a future in exhibition. It could be that this is a consolidation that is a long time coming and maybe perhaps overdue. You know, some chains that have better balance sheets might survive better than others. AMC is already in pretty dire circumstances. Its debt has been rated kind of basically junk bond level. But I think the question is, what happens to exhibition? Do the studios look to other theater chains, or do they start pulling movies out of theatrical release and put them straight on their video and streaming platforms? I mean, Disney has Disney Plus, NBC Universal is about to launch its own streaming platform. So I don't know, it could be a real turning point in terms of the future of movie theaters.
And that's what I was going to ask you, John, when it comes to film companies, the big studios trying to find alternatives now. I mean, that could be the next step, right? Where there's not as many movie theaters to go to, and the movie theater in your own living room will be the one that you attend most of the time.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think we've already started to see that. There have been some movies that have been in theatrical release that are going very quickly, much faster than usual, from theaters, which obviously are closed now, into streaming and video on demand platforms, you know, movies like Birds of Prey. Universal, which has always been kind of aggressive in shortening the so-called window between a film's theatrical release and its appearance on streaming or video on demand, is going to take its Trolls sequel straight to streaming and video on demand. I think there are going to be companies down the line that are going to say, why do we want to split the money with a movie theater? We know that people are going to show up for our Star Wars movies or our Fast and the Furious film. So why don't we release it on our own platforms where we can keep 100% of the money, not split it with the exhibitors? And listen, you know that people are watching a ton of Hulu, a ton of Netflix right now. I think the way that audiences think about content, the way they think about movie going, is changing in real time as we speak.
That's John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks, eh?
Now, we all know that all the major sports leagues are on hold, but it also has filtered down to the high school level. Last year, Palisades High, their baseball team, came close to being the first school not from the San Fernando Valley to win an LA City baseball championship in the highest division in 27 years. 1992 is the last time that happened. This season, they looked even stronger, but then the coronavirus wiped out their chance to prove that 2019 was not a fluke.
The lifelong friends I've made in this definitely make it worth it, but it's definitely sad to know that I'm not really going to get a chance to play in a competitive environment again, especially in high school.
That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Today, Barbara Ferrer, LA County's Director of Public Health, reported a total of 6,910 cases of COVID-19 in the county. That's an additional 22 deaths. That brings the county's total number of deaths to 169 and the mortality rate here to 2.4%. Now, with that in mind, let's hear from someone working to bring that number down, someone who's on the front lines of this pandemic. Emmanuel Codadadi is a registered nurse at USC Verdugo Hills Hospital in Glendale. He works in the hospital's emergency department, and though he's had over a decade of experience in medicine, he's never quite faced anything like this.
As a nurse, I have always been in a setting where I've not known who's walking into the doors, whether this person may have tuberculosis or meningitis or is psychotic and on street drugs trying to stab our staff members. So this pandemic that's going on right now is new to me, but not so new in the emergency room level setting. In the past few weeks, what we have been seeing is a small surge, clusters of patients coming in, and about 95% of these patients are either positive or under surveillance for test results to come back, may or may not be positive. At Verdugo Hills Hospital, a lot of things have changed due to this crisis that we're facing with COVID-19. About a month ago, since we had our first case, we have transformed the whole hospital to accommodate the public. There's different phases that are going on right now. We are, I believe, in phase 3, where we have converted the emergency room to handle any surge or influx of patients, whether they are walking in with mild flu-like symptoms or on an extreme level where they need life support, known as ventilators, to be taken care of. We are facing the unknown. We can't tell who may or may not have it when they're being hospitalized until the results are back. This is why it's crucial for the public to stay home and to listen to the proper authorities and take their advice and isolate themselves from their family, friends, coworkers. If they don't have to go out, they shouldn't be going out. The people that are actually carrying this virus are not your typical flu-like signs and symptoms, the people that are spreading it. So when a patient comes into the emergency room for a chief complaint that's totally irrelevant to any kind of cold-like signs or symptoms, may just be the person who actually has the coronavirus. As an ER nurse, I can honestly say that it is scary. I see my coworkers, I see doctors having anxiety attacks because they're not sure what they are going to be possibly exposed to, even with all the personal protective equipment that we have and every precaution we take to properly gown up and mask up and walk into a room and take care of a patient who is sick and dying, there's still a small percentage that you can be exposed. The hospital is doing their 100%, I feel, and I think that we as nurses and doctors, firefighters, EMTs, police officers, anybody out in the front lines, we still have to use our common sense. We have to think fast and we have to move slow. We have to also help each other. Teamwork, knowledge, and respect for one another will be our best defense. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war with a disease, a microbiological problem here. We have to be brave. We have to be braver now than ever. If the authorities are telling us to stay home, we really need to stay home. We should only go out right now if we absolutely need to do something. We shouldn't be out going on walks with crowded streets and people around us. We shouldn't be going to the market if we don't really need supplies. We have to love, respect, and care for one another so we can all get through this together.
That was Emmanuel Codadadi, a registered nurse in the emergency department at USC Verdugo Hills Hospital in Glendale, recounting his experience on the front lines of this pandemic. All right, now for a teenage baseball player's take on the coronavirus. But first, let me set the stage a little bit. High schools from the San Fernando Valley dominate baseball in the city of Los Angeles. It's not an opinion. It's actually in the record book. The last time a high school not located in the San Fernando Valley won a baseball championship in the highest division was in 1992. Before that, 1972. That's why it was a big deal last year when Westside's Palisades High broke through and squared off against the reigning champs, Lake Balboa Birmingham, in the Division I finals. That game lasted over 3.5 hours, but Palisades fell short 9-5, and Birmingham won their third straight title. Considering local history, some thought Palisades' run was a fluke. So heading into 2020, the team was burning to prove everyone wrong. Then the coronavirus hit, school moved online, and sports, like just about everything else, got put on hold. This past Friday, the California Interscholastic Federation announced the inevitable that all spring sports, including baseball, were canceled. So now Palisades High won't get a chance to prove that it was more than a one-year wonder. Julian Jacobson is a senior at the school and a catcher and captain on the baseball team. Julian, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Julian, before we get into what the CIF announced on Friday, I want to just go back a minute just before, say, January. Heading into December, you guys are obviously working out, getting ready for the 2020 season. Why did you guys think that you had a good shot to prove that 2019 wasn't a fluke?
We really thought our team was pretty much the opposite of what we had last year. Last year, we really had no expectations going into it from outsiders. Within our team, we knew what we could do. We knew that we had all the pitching to go deep into the playoffs. This year, I think it was kind of the opposite. We really expected to have all the hitting that really was at us on top, which really we sort of missed last year. And I really think the big thing this year is that people thought for sure that the year before was a fluke, that we just somehow got lucky and the dice rolled our way. And this year, I really think we were incredibly motivated that we were going to prove everyone wrong and really make a deep playoff run.
And then you also know how to get there, right? You did it last year. You know the roadmap. Very, very tough, but you understand what it takes. So nothing would have come to a surprise for Palisades High School in 2020.
Yeah, definitely the experience from last year played a big factor into this year. This season, straight off the bat, we played very good teams in San Pedro and Kennedy, and we really knew how to compete in those big games. And this year, even though we weren't expected to have great pitching, we had incredible pitching. That was really our strong suit this year. We really felt that if the season kept going, we would have flipped the script for sure.
Julian, when did you guys get a sense that, with the coronavirus pandemic spreading around the world, that this might derail everything that we've worked for a few years now? What part of the early part of this year did you think, that we might not be able to play anymore?
It was probably in the beginning of March when we had a very tough set of games. We had San Pedro and Granada Hills on back-to-back days. And when we had the Granada Hills game, we were sort of seeing online that the CIF was talking about closures, and the Western League and all the other people online were saying, oh no, like we might have to close down for 2 weeks, might have to restart after spring breaks. And that definitely got to us, but we definitely kept in mind that once we're on the field, if we have the opportunity to play, we're going to play as hard as we can. And unfortunately, that Granada Hills game that we were looking forward to, that's right when schools got canceled. So that was unfortunate.
Talking to Julian Jacobson, senior catcher and captain on the Palisades High School baseball team. Okay, so you told me like when you thought, okay, this might be in jeopardy now. The CIF made the announcement on Friday. But by then, you had to have had a sense, this is it, right? That my senior year, that it's all wiped out. I mean, at what point did you think, okay, I'm resigned myself to believe and understand that my senior year is over?
Yeah, probably I'd say a week or two into the quarantine, kind of got a sense of a feeling just watching the news, watching the governor and the mayor kind of saying the rough outlook for schools being closed and the stay-at-home order. So it was definitely a tough realization at first, one that I think I had pretty early that, all right, we're probably not going to go back to school. We're not going to have prom or any of those amenities, and probably season's going to be over. And that was definitely a tough realization. But I think for me, and I think the rest of my senior class, we really wanted to leave a legacy that even though if we didn't win it this year, we wanted to prove to the teams after us in the years that come after us that they still have a job to do and that they can take after our lead. And that's really what we wanted to do. And even though this season is going to be canceled, there's still plenty of work to be done for the future teams.
Julian, tell me the range of emotions once you realize that it's all over. I mean, sadness, anger, frustration. Tell me how it all went for you. I mean, this is your senior year. You guys had a good team. As you mentioned, you could have left an amazing legacy, especially if you'd have broken through and beaten one of those San Fernando Valley teams. I mean, what were your emotions like knowing that it was over?
Pretty devastating, really, to be honest. It wasn't that much anger because I understand that the decision was one that had to be made. I mean, it's definitely a depressing one, to be sure, but definitely for the safety of everyone worldwide, it's definitely a smart decision to be made. It was very sad. I mean, the lifelong friends I've made in this definitely make it worth it, but it's definitely sad to know that I'm not really going to get a chance to play in a competitive environment again, especially in high school.
What about all the other senior stuff, like prom and graduation? That stuff got canceled as well. I mean, how are you getting through trying to understand that all this had to happen, but at the same time missing what could have happened?
Yeah, it's definitely tough. I mean, I think a big thing is just keeping perspective. Like our high school coach, Coach Vogel, teaches us just control the controllables. So it's definitely hard to realize that we're not going to have a prom, probably not going to have a graduation, and we're not going to have that final senior walk around campus. That's definitely a sad thing to realize. But also just keeping in mind that we still have, like, I have a great friend group, and we're still going to keep in touch. And even though senior year might be, well, it is over, that we're still going to have those relationships going forward for the rest of our lives.
All this, Julian, is so fresh in our minds right now because we're going through it right now. But at what point do you think, or do you think there will be a point, maybe a year from now, where you look back and think, oh my gosh, this happened to all of us? And I don't know, how do you think you'll feel maybe a year from now?
I think it'll still be pretty surreal. I think this is pretty unprecedented events. I mean, at least for my age, I mean, I'm 18 years old. I was born in 2001. I mean, we were born right out of the dust of the 9/11 attacks. So I think, at least for me, that people around my age group have learned by force. We've had to deal with adversity and rising above it, and hopefully we'll be stronger from it.
Julian Jacobson, senior catcher and captain on the Palisades baseball team. Julian, thanks a lot and good luck in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Have a good one.
It wasn't that long ago when the USNS Mercy hospital ship arrived in LA. It's currently docked to help relieve area hospitals dealing with cases of COVID-19. And hospital ships have actually had a very long history supporting the U.S. military all over the globe. In fact, the one that's off our coast is actually the third Mercy to serve the nation.
The second pair, Mercy and Comfort, were built during World War II. Matter of fact, the second Mercy was built about a mile and a half north of where Mercy is docked right now, right there in Los Angeles.
A complete history of Navy hospital ships when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Good times, there's going to be good times.
Got no job, baby. And my pockets don't seem to have a jingle. But as long as you let me hold you tight, everything is gonna be all right. Oh, yes, it is. Everything is gonna be all right, baby. Listen to me.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The USNS Mercy has been docked in Los Angeles since the end of March. Its role is to treat patients who are not suffering from COVID-19, relieving hospitals that are handling people with those symptoms. Meanwhile, the USNS Comfort has been docked in New York City with the aim to do the same. The Navy has a history of answering the call during crises like this with its hospital ships, so we called up Sal Mercogliano to talk about it. He's a professor of history at Campbell University and a former merchant mariner. Sal, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, we don't have pandemics very often, thankfully, but naval hospital ships, just like the Mercy, have been around a long time. What is their core role?
Well, the core role is to support the military in time of conflicts. And as a matter of fact, the very first hospital ship, Mercy, there's been three of them, was used to help Navy personnel during the First World War and, as a matter of fact, handle the first pandemic, the Spanish flu.
So floating hospitals, that's essentially what we're talking about.
That's right. Floating hospitals have been around for a long time. We saw the very first floating hospital in the United States during the Civil War. But really in the 20th century, we start seeing them quite a bit. And they're used to treat patients and issues coming from Navy ships. And then during World War II, they were used to transport soldiers and Marines from the battlefield back to the United States.
What about Mercy and Comfort? Give us some backstory on those two ships.
Sure. Well, those ships are actually the third of a pair of ships named Mercy and Comfort. The first pair was during the First World War. They were used to treat soldiers of the American Expeditionary Force coming back from the war. The second pair, Mercy and Comfort, were built during World War II. Matter of fact, the second Mercy was built about a mile and a half north of where Mercy is docked right now, right there in Los Angeles. And so she was actually fitted out right there on the other side of the bridge where Mercy is anchored. The current Mercy and Comfort were built in the late 1980s. That was a result of the Cold War buildup and the potential for conflict in the Middle East. One of the things that was realized was if the United States became heavily engaged in the Middle East, there were no medical facilities, U.S. medical facilities, close by. So what they did is they designed hospital ships that were large, Mercy and Comfort, 895 feet long, 105 foot wide, nice big stable platform so that they can load up with patients from a battlefield and then sail away to a port to fly those patients off to land facilities.
You mentioned the Mercy and Comfort were built in the 80s, so they're around 40 years oldish. What's the shelf life for a ship like that? Will it get updated, or just does it get rebuilt to a completely brand new ship at some point?
Comfort and Mercy were heavily, obviously, modified in the 1980s to take the hospital facilities on board, and they have been updated quite frequently. There was a plan, actually, to retire Comfort in 2018, But both ships have proven of such great service to the nation and the Navy that they've decided to extend their services. And now it's planned that those two ships will not be replaced until the mid-2030s when they're about 60 years old.
Wow, that's amazing that they can last that long. But I guess if you keep updating them, I guess they're going to keep lasting as long as you need them to. Sal, how long does it take to build a ship like the Mercy or the Comfort?
Well, if you were to all of a sudden, you know, President Trump talked the other day about these ships are so great that we should have some more of them, it would take probably about 3 years to design, develop, and construct a fairly new ship. There are options to take ships in hand and convert them, possibly a passenger liner or a tanker, much like Mercy and Comfort, which would take a little less time than that. But it's a very extensive conversion process on board those ships. So you're looking at about 3 years.
Any interesting stories about the Mercy during the time of the outbreak of the Spanish flu? Because I know that, you know, that's one of the big times of its use.
Sure. The original Comfort and Mercy were converted from passenger liners. They were actually some of the very first troop ships that were used in World War I to take over the American Expeditionary Force. The Navy realized they needed some hospital ships, and so they were taken in hand. And Mercy, which had been previously the Saratoga, was converted. She was based down in Norfolk, and that was one of the terminal sites for the troops going across to Europe. And so she started treating patients from the troop ships coming back that were coming down with these flu-like symptoms. And so actually Comfort and Mercy were some of the very first ships to deal with the Spanish flu as those patients started coming back into the United States.
Talking to Sal Mercogliano. He's a professor of history at Campbell University, former merchant mariner. Now, okay, so when it comes to the Comfort and Mercy today, how are they intended to be utilized when they were deployed last month?
So Comfort and Mercy are designed for taking battlefield casualties. So imagine trauma that you would see off a battlefield. And when they were deployed at the end of March, they were intended to go into Los Angeles and New York and handle the overload from the cases in the hospitals that were non-COVID-19. As you're hearing right now, there's plans possibly to shift Comfort over to start taking COVID-19 patients. The issue with doing that on board a hospital ship is fairly significant because hospital ships are basically floating communities. They produce their own water, they produce their own air, they produce everything they need on board the vessel to be self-contained so that they can operate far from land. And when you introduce a contaminant like COVID-19, then there's really not a design. The ships were not envisioned for this type of a role to handle COVID-19. They're actually designed to keep diseases out so that should there be a chemical or radiological attack, they don't get anything inside. They're not really designed to segregate diseases on the internal side.
So it's like its own little ecosystem in a way.
It is. It's a self-contained little environment. You know, it's 1,200 people, you know, medical doctors, civilian mariners, and then you add 1,000 patients on board. So you're talking about 2,200 people who have to have everything you need for every day, food, facilities for water, for bathroom, for everything.
Sal, what would happen if the Comfort in New York City starts taking in COVID patients?
Well, I think one of the things they would have to do is reconfigure the style of the hospital. So right now she's configured a 1,000-bed hospital for trauma patients. A lot of those beds, almost 900 of them, are in these large open bay areas. Obviously, with COVID-19, you'd want to put some distances between them. Each of the ships have an intensive care unit for about 80 patients, a post-operative area for about 20 patients. But the rest of the beds on board the ship are these large open bay areas. And obviously, you'd lose some beds in that. You would probably have to see about a reduction about the half the capacity of the vessel, probably down to 400 or 500 patients.
Now, in Los Angeles, the medical staff at the Mercy have only seen about 24 patients. Any sense of why there aren't more when it has actually 1,000 beds on it?
I think it takes a little bit of time to integrate those facilities, Mercy and Comfort, into the medical systems in New York and Los Angeles. It's like opening a brand new hospital. You know, you have to wait for your clientele, so to speak, to show up. And I think once the other hospitals come to realize the capabilities that Mercy and Comfort have, they'll start using them more and tapping into them more.
So I think a lot of Angelenos and a lot of New Yorkers probably are thrilled to see those two ships off their shore. How long will these ships be docked in these ports, you think? How long is the expectation as far as them being out there?
The Navy has made this an open-end deployment, and understand that that deployment is not restricted to New York and Los Angeles. Should, you know, all of a sudden the casualties start going down in New York and Los Angeles, but all of a sudden spring up somewhere else, one of the things that make these ships so useful and so versatile is the fact they can throw off lines, fire up the boilers, and head down to another port should they need them. And that's one of the great utilities of these vessels is their mobility, their ability to steam at 17 and a half knots and all of a sudden leave Los Angeles and be in San Francisco the next day or Seattle 2 days from then.
Sal Mercogliano, professor of history at Campbell University, talking to us about the role of Navy hospital ships like the Mercy throughout history. Sal, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Comedian Nikki Glaser gets very personal when she takes the stage. She talks a lot about dating, relationships, and being single. Actually, more about how freakishly unlucky she is at all three. And now, whenever she's able to get back on tour, Nikki is planning to add plenty of stories about all the dates that she is not going on.
Art is going to be impacted so much by this, and we don't even know in what way. But my next special is going to be a lot about this time.
The funniest single lady in the world, Nikki Glaser, is next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Our final conversation on the show today is a lot of fun, but a fair warning, it is a little bawdy, not really for the younger set. All right, now, no one knows how things are going to be when the coronavirus pandemic passes. Now, just a guess, but there's probably a lot that we used to take for granted that will never be the same, like dating. So today, instead of reaching out to a dating coach or relationship expert, we're going to go to the front lines of the dating wards, to someone who has seen it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly side of dating, a warrior with stories to tell.
I came up with a plan. I was like, oh, I'll only have sex with guys who I would never want to love, right? That I'll never, like, want them to be my boyfriend. So I pick a guy with, like, a necklace, right? Like a dangly outer necklace. Not an inside one, because you can't ever predict those. Girls, we've all slept with guys with necklaces where we didn't know it was there until we got naked with them. And then you see it and you're like, okay. Feel like I wouldn't be doing this right now if I knew that that was there. I really feel a little bit hoodwinked by you at this moment, but our shirts are off, so...
Nikki Glaser's Netflix special is called Bangin'. Her Sirius XM show and podcast is called You Up, and she's also the host of Bravo's Blind Date. Nikki Glaser, welcome to Take Two. It's an honor.
Thank you so much for having me and calling me a dating expert or, like, It seems like I have a lot more experience than I do. I just have a lot of opinions. And the experience I have had has been so disastrous that I avoid it completely now.
But that's enough. I mean, you're okay. So even if you're a cautionary tale in that way, that's helpful for people.
It is. I think so. I just, at this point, I'm so tired of dealing with men and not knowing what I want or how to get what I want that I've kind of just given up completely. In my career, I've just been able to achieve whatever I want. But with men, I just feel completely out of my element. I just don't know what to do anymore.
Now, just for people that don't know, I want to establish your personal credentials for a second. So I went on the website datingcelebs.com, and that website states, Nikki Glaser is currently single according to our records. As of 2020, Nikki Glaser is not dating anyone. Is all that still true? Is that updated information?
Yes, I am as single as one could possibly be. Like, no prospects, not even someone that I have any hope in, not even a crush. I mean... especially with the situation as it is, it's hard to develop feelings for anyone. And so I am very, very single. Yes.
Is that actually maybe for someone like you, a creative person that's writing, that's thinking about material, is that actually not necessarily a bad thing? You get to kind of hunker down and think of new stuff for when you get to go back out on the road or a comedy club.
Yeah, I mean, there's good things about being single for sure, because I am an introvert and I like my alone time. But I think I would give up all of my like achievements to have a partnership with someone, because I think that that truly is, you know, I can have TV appearances and have the respect of my peers and sell out theaters. But like, it's cliche, but I think this quarantine has made me realize, like, I got to find someone for the next one. Like, I can't go through this again living at my parents' house or alone, which would be even worse.
We're talking with comedian Nikki Glaser. I'm wondering, Nikki, with this new era of physical distancing, how has that affected the dating world? Because, look, I know guys. I'm technically one. I'm still a dude. And I know that we would use any excuse possible not to commit. So I can imagine there's been millions of guys all over the world, Nikki, that are going, I'd love to commit, but hey, coronavirus.
Right. I think, though, that those men are going to get out of this the same way I am, which is like, this fear of commitment is ridiculous, and it's actually going to prevent you from having the things you want in life. Because now that we all like can't work as much as we want to, or work out, or fill our lives with like mindless activities, that we're realizing how lonely we are. And I think that a lot of guys are going to get out of this and be more open to making connections that are lasting, and you know, trying to find someone to quarantine with next. I hope that's the case. But right now, as it goes for dating, no one's reaching out. I think men, everyone's cooped up, and everyone is self-satisfying too much. And so there's no need to really make a connection, because you can't even be physically intimate with anyone. So everyone's just doing it themselves. And so no one's really horny enough for each other at this point. I think dating is kind of like halted right now because of too much masturbation. That's just my theory.
No, it's probably a theory that most people hold. You know, I was talking to my brother. My brother's single, and he was talking about how dating in 2020 is shaping up kind of like an athlete who tears up their knee and has to miss a whole season of their prime while they recover. I mean, how much water do you think that argument holds, that 2020 could be a lost year in the dating world?
I think you're so right. That was one of the first things that really bummed me out about this, was like, I'm turning 36 during the quarantine, probably on June 1st. And that's just an age at a woman where you're like, oh my God, I'm past my mid-30s. Like, it just is like an age, for me at least, that's like hitting a nerve. And for me to be single during that and not even have the opportunity to find someone, and like, I'm aging faster every day because I'm in my mid-30s. I mean, I feel like I'm angry at the missed time and the missed opportunity to make those connections, because it takes so long to find someone you like, and it takes so much work. And we're just, like, I feel the same way about like staying in shape. I really am not even trying to attract a man right now. I'm not putting out thirst traps on Instagram. I'm not trying to look hot. I'm not putting on makeup. I'm gaining weight. I think, we're all going into some kind of like hibernation right now. And so I'm just leaning into being single right now. I'm not really even thinking about it.
So, wondering, as a comedian who finds humor in dating and sex, I'm wondering if maybe right now you're working on any material related to all this that we're going to hear later.
Well, I mean, I don't work on material. Like, I don't sit down at a computer and like think about what am I going to talk about. So the way that I work on material is just going on stage and talking. But like, I am definitely making observations that will find their way to the stage, because honestly, I have no desire to go on stage right now, because all of my material that I was excited about when this all went down is not really important right now. And no one really wants to hear about my observations about how a guy won't text me back when we don't, this isn't the time for my the comedy I was building. So I have to go out and build a whole new set that's going to reference this insane world that we're living in. But I don't know what that looks like yet at all. I'm kind of just living it right now. I'm collecting data, and then it will all come out later.
You're like a scientist, a comedy scientist.
Yeah, I mean, like, every comedian's going to be referencing it on stage, just as every movie, every TV show. Art is going to be impacted so much by this, and then we don't even know in what way. But my next special is going to be a lot about this time, and a lot before the time. Like, it's just like, and how things have changed. I hope they don't change too much, but honestly, I needed a little shake up. I needed to feel alive again and be like, oh, wait, what's important? I think it's going to be good.
All right, Nikki, every comedian I've talked to gets the same final question, and it's in the form of a clip from History of the World, okay. Part 1. It's Mel Brooks defining what a comedian means to society.
Occupation?
Stand-up philosopher.
What?
Stand-up philosopher. I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
Oh, a bullshit artist.
Okay, Nikki Glaser, stand-up philosopher for people that are searching for viable, logical comprehension about what's going on in dating during a pandemic. What would you say to them?
I love that clip so much. I would say it's not looking good, but that can also be a good thing. And you know what? That's life in general. Like, it's not looking good. We're all going to die someday. But that's okay, too. The finite time we have on Earth that might be a little bit more finite than we thought is only going to inspire us to love more, to love deeper, to make connections, to face our fears. So it's not looking good, but that's not a bad thing. That's what I'll say.
Nikki Glaser, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Nikki Glaser's Netflix special is called Bangin'. Her SiriusXM show and podcast is You Up, and she's also the host of Bravo's Blind Date. All right, now a quick tip for dealing with quarantine. This one courtesy of Walt Disney. Up on the Disney Parks blog, you can find the recipe for Disneyland's oh-so-delicious churro bites. And we'll get it up on take2.org this afternoon. It'll for sure help you fill the time and hopefully satisfy your soul a bit. But I warn you, it involves a lot of butter. Thank God for that. All right, so that is it for us today. And we always like hearing from you, so feel free to reach out with a question or a comment. You can find us on Twitter, at Take2. That's at Take2. Same with Facebook. You can email us at take2show@kpcc.org. Or how about this? Call us. Leave us a message. 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2, back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.